Adagimo, The Messenger, a public affairs program presented in cooperation with the Upper Midwest American Indian Center.
Monday through Friday, from your Mosher Radio. It's become invisible through Minorities in Focus. An inside look into the lives of persons living or deceased. Now becoming visible through Minorities in Focus from Umoja Radio.
Song of the Black Mountain. There was a black mountain in the ocean. There was an unseen cloud coming toward that mountain. It went into the black mountain and made it wet.
Greetings, my name is Mark Client-Houle, and this is the second in a series of programs which are being produced by the Center for Communication and Development through a grant which was made possible from the Minnesota Humanities Commission in conjunction with the National Endowment for the Humanities. This week's program will deal with Indians in the media. Indian people for a long time have used a different form of communication, perhaps very unfamiliar to Anglos, that form being song, powwows, and smoke. Oh, that's not true of all Indian people. There are those, a small number, who know how to use the media correctly. And then there are those who think that they know how to use the media. Today is my guest. I have Mr. Eddie Benton Benai, who is director of the Red Schoolhouse and who was recently named Indian Educator of the Year. Our interview will start when I ask Mr. Benai about the 50s and the 60s and what the situation in the Twin Cities was for Indian people at that time.
Well, I came here as an iron worker, as a high steel construction worker in the late 1957. I was pretty fortunate, really. I was already a journeyman iron worker and had a very good reputation for my work. And I came here with a high-powered construction company, a worldwide construction company. It was the erection division of United States Steel. And so I was fairly well established in terms of employment. I didn't get really involved with the Indian community as such until the summer of 1958. In 1958, the life for Indian people here was pretty grim. I remember one of the first things I did when I came here was to look into the Indian youth activities, and there were none. And the attitude of Indian people at that time was pretty sad in terms of unity, community involvement. And those kinds of community action programs that have been so prevalent in the past few years and have produced much of what is positive for Indians now are just practically non-existent. At that particular time, everything was more or less channeled through existing community service agencies. The old Waite neighborhood house, the like. But they had no programs for design for Indians. They didn't know what to do, really. So there were no Indian-oriented kinds of programs, and people didn't really know how to go about getting them. Generally, that was, in that particular type of situation, that was the attitude. But at the youth level, as I said, it was practically non-existent, and it was pretty hard to get a group of Indian people together and to move on any one particular issue, much less get them interested in one particular issue. Myself and a small group of people at that time, which was early 1958, but began talking about the possibility of establishing an Indian center in the Twin Cities. And to show you the contrast, some of our professional social service Native Americans, they weren't Native Americans then, sent out a questionnaire behind our back and said, there's been a lot of talk about an Indian center. Who needs it? With no chance on the questionnaire to answer positively. The attitude at that time was to protect one's job at wherever it was working.
You know, thinking back to those years, I'm wondering, can you remember what the media or how the media dealt with Indian people at that time? And I'm talking about at the beginning of the formation of the American Indian Movement, those years.
Well, the period of time in which I'm talking about is at least 10, 11 years before the formation of the American Indian Movement. And the question is, how did the media treat Indian people at that particular time? They didn't. They didn't treat them at all. I remember in particular one of the largest Indian community meetings that was ever called at that particular time probably comprised a meeting of in the neighborhood of 200 Indian people. We'd tried very hard to raise that many Indian people, and we invited everybody from every social service agency we could think of, to the police department, to the fire department, to the employment and security division, the Red Cross, and the like. They didn't come, and the media didn't come either. So, Indians weren't news those early days. So the media was pretty much inaccessible to us. You had to create something really, really sensational and really, really out of this world to get media attention. But one thing I do recall, though, is that in those early times, especially in the newspaper industry, if an Indian committed a crime, the term race, Indian, always followed his name. The same is true in the television media. If the person was a minority, his particular race always followed the mentioning of his name. And those things were very detrimental and very negative.
You know, when we were talking about doing this project and conversing with some people, some Indians from around the Twin Cities, whose names I will not get into right now, but there was the general feeling that Indian people perhaps maybe should not get involved in the media or use the media until we learn correctly to project affirmative images. These are all a bunch of fancy words, I know. What do you think about that? Do you think that we have any affirmative... is there any affirmative... Oh, I'm looking for the word, but I can't find it. Images of people within the Twin Cities. Are there any people within the Twin Cities that you can think of that project these affirmative images that people talk about?
Well, let me touch first on the how that's come across to the media, and should we use the media? I've been hearing that ever since I first became involved in the struggle for self-determination, which was 1958. Because prior to that, as I said, I was, only interested in my own career as a iron worker and in ultimately I hoped structural engineer. But at that particular time, I was very interested in athletics, and so my interest was centered around baseball, basketball, and boxing. And the projection of a positive image for Native Americans, as I said, is something that the media either didn't care about or didn't know about at that time. Because, as I said, all of the old movies, the stereotyping, the reaffirming of stereotypes of Native Americans as projected by, first of all, the curriculum in schools and in newspapers, derogatory kinds of stories, were also the fabric of any news, if any at all, that were projected by the media. And anything contrary to that, or anything to despoil that that attitude, that mentality, was to me a media taboo. I mean, you didn't focus on the good things. You focused on the drunken Indian. If it was an accident, it had to be a sensational accident, and the Indian had to be in the wrong. And if it was a portrayal or a news item, for that matter, involving an Indian person, the portrayal was always the negative or the sensational. So the projection of positive image for Native Americans in the media was nil. It just wasn't there. And I think, by and large, the people who controlled the media determined that policy, even though we as Indian people have tried to change it. But then you see, I think what has happened, though, in a development is that we as Indian people suddenly realized that in order to get in front of the camera, in order to get Indian issues, whatever they may be, in the front of the mass of population, he had to create something sensational. I mean, they just weren't going to come out for a historic opening of an Indian boys club, or for the first time in history, an Indian little league is in the championship, or a hospital opens an Indian-oriented program. That hasn't got it. It has to be sensational. And and again, it's a falling back on the old philosophy and brainwash of the vanishing Indian, valiant fighter, lord of the plains, garbage kind of stuff. Indian families, even unto this day, who have worked all of their lives to clothe, educate, shelter their children, do not make news. And so Indian people learn very quickly how to attract the media. But which ain't so bad. You've got to get it one way or another. You've got to focus attention one way or another. But I think the wrong in that is that we got molded into something that we couldn't get out of. We had to kick down doors. We had to do things, political confrontations, demonstrations, whatever would put us on the pages of the press. And we got to know newsmen and people in the media. But then those very same people, even on to this day, don't expect anything else from us. You know, the attitude is, what the heck does it matter that the Red Skulas has been struggling for survival for 5 years, saving, along the way, saving probably a couple million dollars in taxpayers' money. That's not news. We have a, for the first time, an all-Indian graduation program where we've completed a scholastic year, an academic year, where the Red Skulas enjoyed a 92% retention rate. You know, that doesn't get it. You know, But if an Indian runs out here, and again, like I said, we've been classified into a mold. It's almost as bad as the old stereotypes that were happening in the 50s and in the early 60s. Yeah. You expect us to do something dramatic. We're not actors, and I don't particularly want to be an actor. I want to see Indian children have a chance, an equal chance.
What sort of image do you think that the Wounded Knee Indian people, through the media?
Well, through the media, very distorted image. But again, if you realize, even if you're an Indian or non-Indian, black, Chicano, if you realize how the media was controlled in that situation, you know what actually came out of what kind of press releases and what kind of news releases were being sifted to the outside. Who was the censor then? Was the public the censor? Hell no. It's the United States government and its forces. So who controlled the media then? I don't care if they're NBC, CBS, or an independent station. Yeah? They were controlled, and whether they know it or not, they were controlled.
How do you think we could erase that image that we have? I'm aware that that image is stuck with people. I'm aware that in my time living in here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which has been limited, I've moved around the cities quite a lot, though, just to get a feel. And I get different feedback from different people when I tell them, and I'm an Indian. You know, if you go up to somebody and say, you're French-Canadian, that's a different story. How do you think we could use the media to help erase that image?
Well, as I see it, the problem really is larger than that. For instance, in my particular case, I really bought the union, the unionism apprenticeship as my way to do something that I liked very much, which is high steel construction work. Through that particular process, I know that the reason for these training, particularly training programs, as it relates to the ironworker profession, which has a 98% fatality accident rate. That means 98% of all accidents are fatal, mm-hmm. Which was a hell of a challenge to me. I mean, to get up there and walk around beams, whether they were 7 stories or 97 stories, and do your work, is something that was very challenging, very satisfying to me. That particular process I understand and appreciate, because the process as it relates to safety, your own safety, you know that that program is going to sift out all those who might unthinkingly drop a 90-pound chain hoist on you or a bucket of bolts, you know, which could cause your demise. I understand that and appreciate that, because it has to do with my particular life. I mean, if a guy's going to come to me and say, and a superintendent's going to tell him, you work with this guy today, I want to know that guy knows what he's doing, because he has my life in his hands as I do his. Well, I think in the media, conversely, I believe some of the standard practices of that filtering and sifting ought to either be lifted or swept aside, so that people might be able to express ideas, images, whether they be an interview or a puppet show. That there are Indian people out there with imagination. There are Indian people out there who have a gift of expression in many different fields. But the process of protection, which is, you know, a process of protection, these cameramen have been trained, and trained properly so. But there are Indian people out there with the desire to become a cameraman. There's people out there with the desire to become an interviewer, and there's people out there with the ability to do that. Some special kinds of inroads of attraction must be established. And, you know, I think it has to be done without demonstration, without public confrontation, without political confrontation. industry, media industry people have got to realize that they're there somewhere, but that their own process of education and training sometimes locks out those kind of people. And we as Indian people, of course, I think it's incumbent upon us to keep getting up every day, you know, and keep trying. Because that's what it is for me. It's a struggle for survival and ultimately self-determination.
I wanted to get a little bit into, briefly, just the American Indian movement. I guess that a lot of people have a very, probably, perhaps a distorted view of the American Indian movement. I don't think that some people realize, perhaps, of all the good that the movement has done for Indian people. Your involvement or the involvement of the Red Schoolhouse, you're the director of the Red Schoolhouse, there has been a tie with the American Indian movement. Is that so? And what is that tie?
That's a largely a philosophical tie. The philosophical tie is the struggle for survival and self-determination. That's philosophy. Beyond that, it's the spiritual. It's a spiritual tie. I'm a believer in the original concept of spiritual survival and spiritual revolution of Native American people. And I still cling to that, and I still try to live by that. Some of the other things that the American Indian Movement have been into, political confrontation, demonstration, and the like, were the things that they were forced to do. A lot of people will cringe at the thought of the American Indian Movement because they've been led to believe by the media that they're a revolutionary, radical organization. But you have to remember, they had to be. But yet, you take the American Indian Movement and the tactics that it's had to do to get the attention are the very same tactics that unions, labor unions, have had to do for many years. You talk about violence. And at the time of the organizing of many of the labor unions and the unions of all of these people that are now organized in different unions have a history of violence. How could it have been any different with us? And, you know, our ultimate aim was not, you know, the unionizing of all Native American people of the country, but the coming together of we as a people and the realization that we are a people, an individual people, you know. Now, if that translates into unionism, radicalism, revolutionary, so be it. That's the way it had to be.
As the director of the Red Schoolhouse, do you foresee any use of the media in which we could use it to educate non-Indian people about the traditional ways of Indian people and the importance of preserving those?
Very definitely so, but again, the doors must be opened. I mean, there must be adequate funding to these kinds of programs so that we can, you know, we can put on something beside this plant here and this blue platform we're sitting on. We've got to have the kind of funding so that we can educate the people. I hesitate to estimate how many people are watching this particular program this morning as opposed to something else. If we had the resources, if we had the money, I know that there are people probably in the industry who would come forward and help us if that's what we needed. But we, you know, the whole problem is whatever we attempt, it must be 10 times better than what's available anywhere else. And that mentality, I really believe in excellence too. I mean, I believe in putting on just the best that you're capable of, and then triple that, and you're probably at my caliber. But if we can get people in control of the media and programs and others to stop thinking about what will that turn over in terms of dollars and cents for the time being. If we had an early base foundation, so to speak, if we could, for instance, have the Red Schoolhouse do six programs on this, we would prove something, I think. If we had a chance to do it without having to sell ourselves down a river, without having to cut our hair, without having to change our image.
Indian people, the media, and images. Some thoughts and feelings from Eddie Benton and I. Not only to some of us, Indian Educator of the Year, but an Indian from the heart. On this next program, another educator with also some profound thoughts on Indian people, the media, and images.
How do you think the Indian community could go about using the media to present ourselves in a more positive fashion? Or do you think we should use it at all?
Well, I'm undecided about that, but I'll tell you what I think one of the major problems is in attempting to use the media, and that is American people know very little about their own history. And if you start bringing up historical situations, a great many of them reject the truth because they have not been taught that it was that way. They've been taught something entirely different. That's the reason we have this tremendous emotionalism over the Maine Indians. Maine Indians won a lawsuit based on a federal statute that said you can't sell their land without Congress approving it.
Right.
Now, if the American public knew American history, they would know that was one of the first acts of the United States Congress, and it's the law of the land. You see, in communicating to the general public, there's always an assumption by Indian people that the non-Indians know as much about their own history as we do, that when we talk about religion, that they really understand the dimension of religion, and when we talk about land, that they understand land in terms more comprehensive than something that you wave a paper deed and say, this is my land. And I think we should use the media, but we have to recognize that the majority of our effort really should go at the highest levels of thinking in attempt to bring non-Indian thinkers into a broader perspective. And it's extremely difficult because there aren't that many people in this society that think to begin with.
That was Vine Deloria. On the next program of Becoming Visible, Minorities in Focus. The preceding views of this program do not necessarily represent those of the Minnesota Humanities Commission nor the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Mark Hull. Thank you.